Coming from dozens of countries from all parts of the Latin world, from Cuba to Mexico, the Caribbean islands, South America, the Latin American identity encompasses a variety of cultures, backgrounds, stories, traditions, and of course, music. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and today on Central Standard, a listen to how Latino beats with African-inspired rhythms and a variety of instruments, and of course, dance, have influenced jazz, pop music, mambo, salsa, rock, hip-hop, and popular culture in the U.S. from post-World War II to the present. Plus, we'll hear how these influences have impacted the Chicano civil rights movement. And we'll hear from some players in the Kansas City local Latino music scene. All that's just ahead, just after this hour's news. Latin music has always found a spot on the main stage of popular music in the United States. From all parts of the Latin world, Cuba, Mexico, the Caribbean islands, South America, representing a vast variety of cultures, backgrounds, and traditions. And, of course, music. Good morning. This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're discussing the role of Latinos in shaping popular culture, primarily from the music scene in the United States from post-World War II to the present. Salsa, merengue, R&B, mambo, jazz, hip-hop, rock, reggaeton, and beyond. Later in the hour, we'll give a listen to some favorite local Latino Chicano bands and check in on the local Latino music scene. But first, I'd like to introduce Greg Carroll, Chief Executive Officer at the American Jazz Museum. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Miguel Carranza, Director of the Latino Chicano Studies Program at UMKC. Good morning. Thanks
Good
for
morning.
Being here as well.
Good morning.
And I should mention, this conversation today is inspired by a Smithsonian exhibit that's currently being hosted at the American Jazz Museum called American Sabor, Latinos and United States Popular Music. The exhibit is free and open through October 27th. And tonight, the museum is hosting a panel of local Latino music scholars. The event is at 6 p.m. More information on our website at kcur.org. So this exhibit has been at the American Jazz Museum. Greg Carroll, how did this come to be hosted here?
Well, we were contacted by the we're an affiliate of the Smithsonian, and we were contacted by the folks at SITES, which is the Services for Institute Traveling Exhibitions and Services, that contacted us, let us know that this exhibit existed, and would we like to host it. As we looked at the elements of the exhibit and saw how it had a great alignment with our mission, it was pretty much a no-brainer for us to bring it on. So after, you know, several months of discussion with our folks at the Smithsonian, we decided let's go ahead and schedule it at our Changing Gallery programming, and we did.
And the exhibit is far beyond jazz. It covers popular music in
That's
the
right.
U.S. But let's start with jazz and some history. Let's
sure.
talk about how Latinos first started coming into the jazz scene in the U.S.
Right. Well, you know, you have to, when you talk about the fusion of jazz and Latin music, you really have to start with a great collaboration between Dizzy Gillespie and Chano Pozo that was very important back in the early 50s, 60s, that where Dizzy Gillespie sort of integrated his orchestra, and with the great Cunganero Candido, who performed in that orchestra, you had such a fusion of great Latin Afro-Cuban rhythms with jazz. And so it sort of sparked this energy of Latin jazz music. And so you had other American musicians like Tito Puente and the Mambo Kings group who were very important, that fused jazz into the icons of Afro-Cuban literature as well. And you had people like Ray Barreto, who's a little more later generation of Tito Puente. And you have people like Machito and his orchestra, who even goes back earlier than Dizzy Gillespie and the other folks that I think did a great job of introducing the music to jazz.
Yeah, even in the 30s and 40s, there were Latinos coming in and joining into the jazz scene here in
That's
America.
Right.
Dr. Miguel Carranza, can you talk about what was going on in America during that time?
Sure. I think one of the things that's really exciting is that with the migration of Mexican origin peoples, even as early as the 1890s, 1900s, we saw a description of their experience in music. And first it was written, and the social factors involved, which I like because I'm a sociologist and an ethnic studies person, is that they really talked about what their experiences were. They put them into words, they developed lyrics, and then they became music, and they became corridos, which were ballads. And so there's even a, for example, there's a corrido de Kansas, of people coming to Kansas, and they talked about that in lyrics, and then they put them to words. A number of famous writers and music people put these words to music. And so it's pretty fascinating. So it describes what the experience was and continues to be today. And so you see corridos becoming music, and then you see them developing into other areas into conjunto music, mm-hmm. the text, what we call, quote-unquote, the Tex-Mex. Mm-hmm. And then you talk about, you know, the Bay Area music and the Texas tornadoes, and, mm-hmm. and then it really goes into the 1940s into jazz. And
right.
So at that time in the 40s, the Latino population, primarily of Mexican origin, but also Puerto Ricans overcoming in the East, and yet there wasn't the increase in Cubans at the time. That wasn't until the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But you have people coming in and developing their genre of music. And it's always been the experience of peoples to describe what their experience has been in the U.S. And then there's always been the other side, is that the crossover music, where they mm-hmm. try to make it big in, quote unquote, the real music area. So you see those kinds of intrusions and pass and crossing over into, and it becomes really bicultural music. And so people start to talk about salsa and mambo and all that who didn't know about it before, and they go, boy, that's a catchy beat. And
mm-hmm.
and even rock. I mean, you had the rock stars who came in, the Ritchie Valens, you had Hannibal and the Headhunters,
mm-hmm.
Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, all Chicanos. And mm-hmm. so you go, wow, I didn't know that. And I think that's the nice thing about mm-hmm. the exhibit, is that it's very comprehensive, and it doesn't just focus just on jazz, but it focuses right. all the different types of music and how they've come to this point, and where they've come to this point from different areas of the country and outside of the country, because you talk about Puerto Rico, you talk about the Caribbean, you talk about Central America and Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and it comes into this blend, and it's amazing. And I'd really like to congratulate Greg and the American Jazz Museum, because this is a major effort. There are only 12 cities in the country that are getting this. And had it not been for the efforts of the American Jazz Museum, I don't know whether we would have had it or not. And
right.
so it's been a lot of cooperation, and it really supports and reinforces Latino identity in a place like Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And so they know that we exist, and we've existed for a long time, and guess what? There was music involved, as well as labor working in the meatpacking industries, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Even those who worked in the meatpacking and railroads sang music.
Were they automatically accepted, even in the 30s and 40s? Was jazz and the music scene kind of a place where everybody could come together, or was there discrimination?
Well, that's a good question. I think I'm going to answer that question. I want to pick up on a point that Dr. Carranza talked about, and that is that there is a correlation, and there is a correlative here with how jazz integrated with social struggles. Jazz was the catalyst. It was oftentimes the backdrop for the civil rights movement. And you saw that same thing occur in various forms of music. In fact, if you even go back to early Baroque and classical music, you see that there is always a connection to what's happening in that culture, to what drives the music that comes out of that culture. And I think that was a very good point that you picked up on. There's this constant infusion of different backgrounds that make up the music. And that's why you have like the Tejano music that creates its unique style. And you have the Mamba and Salsa that are linked directly to Afro-Cuban traditions, which are linked even back to Bayan regions in West Africa. So you have all of these various relationships. In terms of the integration and acceptance, jazz music has always been sort of a, I don't want to say a stepchild of other forms of music, but it's always had, even though it was very popular, particularly during its heyday, in the turn of the century, between, you know, the early 20s and 40s. It was often used as music that would help to sort of, you know, prop up the morale of the country during World War II. But the music itself was very instrumental in integrating artists and putting artists of different backgrounds and social strata together. And it was a way of sort of dismissing or divesting itself from the I would say, the ills of social struggles that brought people together and allowed music to become that blanket, if you will, to quench some of the fires that were created from social ills. So there always was this notion of integration this notion of using the music as a catalyst for social change.
What were some of the first hits during that time, like in the 40s, where people were first getting introduced to this different rhythm and influence?
Wow. Now that you put me on the spot there. Have to dig really deep into my ethnomusicology chops, which aren't here today. So I can't speak to something as early as the 40s, but I know one of the hits that was really popular, particularly with the collaboration of Dizzy Gillespie and the Uno Orchestra, was a tune called Salt and Peanuts, where he took this music and put it to this Afro-Cuban context, and you have boom, salt peanuts, salt peanuts, and so you get this really cool groove that sort of supplants itself over American tunes, and it was really a kind of a light thief, if you will, a light motive.
I have one of those hits, Pachuco Boogie, which we're going to listen to right now, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. Let's hear that now.
Ese, qué alerta le suena a usted, ese, mano. Yo no sabía que usted le pajoleaba tan de aquella, ese. ¿Sabe qué? Ya me agüité, ese, ya la agüita esa por derecho ya me agüitó, y todo me agüitó, vámonos al rol, ese.
Nel, no se vaya hasta hace un ratito, vamos a sonarlos una vez, ¿quiere?
Boogie, y el albel boogie.
That's Pachuco Boogie. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking about the influence of Latinos in molding popular music. This conversation is inspired by a free Smithsonian exhibit at the American Jazz Museum. And the talk is tomorrow night. My apologies.
That's
at 6
right.
p.m. So that song right there called Pachuco Boogie, Dr. Miguel Carranza, talk to us about the Pachucos. What was that about? They're speaking Spanish color. What was that scene like there?
Well, one of the things that happened is that as you had more Latinos come into the country, there was a definite struggle to become part of the country, as there still is today. And that, in terms of adolescents and young adults, they ended up on the outs and didn't have the kind of success in schools, et cetera. And so they sought an alternate lifestyle, and one of the ways they did was to become pachucos. And I've often described pachucos as belonging to a group, an organization. So it was not the same, but to get people to think about it, I think about the Boy Scouts. Pachucos. They're trying to identify themselves. They're trying to be supported by other Latino kids and young adults. And so they get into this lifestyle. Sometimes they get into trouble. And I call them Boy Scout-like. Others would call them gangs. Mm-hmm. And so they talk about their struggle in terms of the musical genres. They talk about not being accepted. In the 40s, we have the Zoot Suit Riots. Mm-hmm. And
tell us about those.
The Zoot Suit Riots were in L.A., and there was a particular style of dress which actually was introduced by African Americans in the U.S. And it was a long coat, suit coat and pants that hung almost to your knees, and mm-hmm. you had a big wide hat, and then you had, if you were lucky, you had the chain, watch and chain, which hung far down, and so that became kind of a style, and it was adopted by a lot of cities, and particularly where there were a majority of Latinos. And so there was this Sleepy Lagoon where a kid was killed, and a Latino kid, and they thought that he was killed by other Latinos, and they figured out, or the police thought they knew who they did it, so they rounded them all up, and It started lots of ill feelings, and then there was the military bases there where there were those from the Navy and from the Marines, and it got into, there was a fight that started, and all of a sudden you had thousands of Navy and Air Force and Marines who were going into Los Angeles, and anybody who was dressed as a zoot suit or who looked Mexican was beat up. Mm. And so that was the first part. And the second part was then they went into Mexican neighborhoods and they still kicked the crap out of them. So it was really hard, and they hardly arrested no non-Mexicans, but arrested a lot of Mexicans for disturbing the peace, and the military had to get their
How did the Pachuco subculture and the music from that kind of influence music today?
I mean, you see it a lot. I mean, the Pachuco boogie, you see it come out in rock music. I mean, there's still, you see it come out in salsa. I mean, it was just a verification of their experience. And so you see they talk about struggles, mm-hmm. whether it's struggles coming across the border or whether it's struggles as a military person in Vietnam or whether mm-hmm. it's a struggle in your community. They talk about passion, you know, love, mm-hmm. lost love.
Right.
I mean, you see that come out in a lot of jazz and blues, and that was another place. My father's favorite music were the Mexican cancieros and canciones that talked about love, and, you know, we call it tequila drinking music because it bring tears to your eyes, and it's like, you know, my lover left me, and tú solo tú, and all these kinds of experiences of emotion. Right. And so it just evolved. And then you have another group of the people as Pachucos who weren't Pachucos who started to get into rock, mm-hmm. and they identified with mm-hmm. early rock, and they wanted to do that. And I'm convinced that there's been this fusion of music, and people start out in rock, end up going, moving, and then end up in jazz.
Right.
And now with the diversity in the Latino population here in this country, you now start to see salsa, different kinds of salsa, mm-hmm. Cumbias, all sorts of things. So it's really exciting.
Well, this is a great opportunity to introduce two more people into our conversation. I just want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We're talking about the Latino and Chicano influence on music. And if you've discovered something surprising that you want to have a question about, you can give us a call, 816-235-2888. Is there a particular artist that's had an influence on your life? You can give us an email, centralstandard@kcur.org, 816-235-2888. I want to bring in Dr. Uciel Piscina, member of Trio Atzlan and assistant professor of education administration at UMKC. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
Yes, it's a pleasure. And then John Curry, director of Marimba Sol de Chiapas.
Good morning, Suzanne. Thanks for having me aboard.
So we've been talking about this influence on this music that you both play music and have been part of the Kansas City Latino music scene for a long time. How has this history influenced your bands?
Well, it's a part of my life and a part of our upbringing. My dad wasn't necessarily a trained musician, but he loved to sing rancheras.
Mm.
And our house was always full of music. And it wasn't just Latin music. It wasn't just rancheras or boleros. I got to hear Ray Charles, the Everly Brothers, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles. My dad grew up during the 50s and the 60s, so he came here as a kid at 14, so loved doo-wop. And so when he, you know, after he came back from Vietnam, he heard all of this wonderful music when he was up in Da Nang, and just brought reels and reels of music, and he would play that all day Sunday. So it just the intersection of all that music.
And can you tell us what ranchera music is for people who might not know?
Oh, ranchera music, I guess, as we play it, we call it Mexican R&B, mm-hmm. Mexican blues, because it is the crying music. I mean, it's that human experience of love gained, love lost, the way we seek it, you know, the way we retain it. And it's just those stories of you know, that generally men, but women would also sing in different occasions. Ranchera music comes from the state of Jalisco. So it's the cowboy music and all different kinds of instruments that are used.
And the way you guys sing it, just to interject, is just when you play it, the authenticity just oozes out of you. I mean, the festival tributes that we presented at the museum with you guys was awesome.
It's the tequila.
It is.
No. It's that spirit that we all have.
Yeah, you know,
you hear it in the howling with Howling Wolf, you know, in the blues and whatnot. It's that howling that we do, the el grito,
and it is,
but it comes from inside, and it is in all of us. But
the Africans call that injinji. That's their core.
Can you give us an example? Give us our listeners, and back up from the mic a little bit, so we don't.
Well, you say you didn't have a wet bar, so it's going to be kind of
missing one important ingredient.
Something like that. So, but but honestly, you don't do it all the time, and that's something that we find a bit strange when you don't grow up in the culture. You don't know when to interject it when we're playing at several restaurants or occasions, and mostly folk who don't understand. I just don't want to say Anglo folk. You just don't do it all the time. It is usually in a chorus when some major words have been said in the song, and you feel it, and you can't hold it in. And it just bursts.
It's like in church, when in the black church, when the spirit overtakes you, there's a lot of hallelujahs, there's a lot of go on, amen, preach going on. Same concept.
Yeah, again, I would say that's the passion.
It's
a passion you feel, you hear in lots of music, and this is an example of it.
And I want to bring in John Curry also. You've been sitting here quietly waiting your turn. Marimba Sol de Chiapas, tell us about your band and how it's brought together some of these ideas, these common themes we've been talking about here.
Well, a lot of people might be surprised to know that there's been a Mexican marimba band based out of Kansas City since 1991. We came to town as a part of the university, part of UMKC, as an ensemble in residence, as Marimba Yajalón. Went through an evolution in 2004 as Marimba Sol de Chiapas. And basically the way the marimba fits into this equation is the Mexican marimba is basically the caretaker of all these music we've just discussed and more in southern Mexico. It's actually, you find more marimbas in southern Mexico than you actually do pianos. And actually, it's often referred to as the Mexican piano. Mm-hmm. Also, the Mexican marimba is very important to some of the musicians that we've discussed and others, because the Mexican marimba was the inspiration for both the marimba in the U.S., but also the vibraphone came out of the marimba tradition in the United States. Some musicians that you may be familiar with, like Lionel Hampton and Red Norvo. Yeah, Norvo, those guys. But not everybody realizes that both Tito Puente, Tito Rodriguez were wonderful vibraphone players. And also the hit you mentioned earlier, the L.A. Pachuco Boogie, the first 1 million seller in the Latino music world, even though it's not featured on that album, Don Tosti, was a very accomplished vibraphonist, amongst other things.
Well, we're going to hear what this sounds like. This is Marimba de Sol. Which one is it? Chiapas, I believe. Here we go. John Curry, describe to us what we're seeing if we're watching this live performance.
Sure. What you're seeing is basically the largest member of the xylophone family. We play on a large 5.5 or 6 octave, basically huge piano keyboard. A lot of people know the xylophone, the marimba, is basically the big sister. There's 4 of us actually performing on one instrument, and so that's a little bit different than the tradition you would normally find in the U.S., but basically we're a band in a box, and that we've got 4 different positions. We've got the bass player down at the low end. We've got the guitarras in the harmony position, or the armonía, and then the 2 upper players on the instrument are considered like the melody and counter melody, and they collaborate to create put the melody and put that melodic support on top of the music that the bass and harmony have created there. So it's basically choreographed movement on this keyboard with mallets that we're all playing. So
how much of this is I don't know, kind of a newer phenomenon to have a band like this in the U.S., this very traditional seeming of Mexico. I mean, we've been talking about the 30s, 40s, 50s. When did it start to see more use of traditional instruments and just kind of mainstream culture?
Well, specific to the marimba, actually, we were our group started back in 1988, and we were actually one of the first Mexican marimba groups that had permanent base in the United States. We started out in East Texas. Now there may be as many as 10 groups nationwide, but that's about it, that actually play the Mexican marimba tradition. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, as far as influence of that type of keyboard in the U.S., you've seen it much more through the vibraphone tradition,
right. Right.
And also through the academic programs, which, by the way, UMKC right. had one of the first percussion major programs in the United States, marimba and vibraphone being, as well as the xylophone being a large part of that. So we have a neat heritage here in the USA. But as far as the Mexican marimba, it's a fairly new and still just very few groups as far as the U.S.
And I was going to, add to that, John, that I'm also a percussionist too. And there's a movement in the percussion world called the Percussive Arts Society. And through that movement, you have the sort of bringing together of different cultural percussion ensembles that represent different cultural regions around the world. And so that's where you begin to see, a lot of these great sort of Mexican-based traditions, Afro-Cuban-based traditions, even more Indian, more West Asian, and as far as European traditions. And so it's because of that kind of movement that it really sort of generated out of the academic scene mm-hmm. that you start to see it sort of migrate into communities, and you start seeing these ensembles perform and begin to have that sort of unique connection to the communities.
And Dr. Uciel Piscina?
It's a very large instrument, so it's not easy to move around. And so, it was purposefully done,
right.
to bring in academically and also spread out a bit. I imagine it is expensive, too, to make.
Yeah, it costs just as much to ship one.
Ship
here
one
as
to make it.
And right. I think the logistics of the size of the instrument definitely has been a factor of it not being more widespread.
And I wanted to speak to the guitar. Dr. Carranza was talking about Mexican cowboys coming in from Texas and bringing what they could bring with them would be a guitar. And so you would have someone telling stories, national stories, news, really, in those corridos. And so, and also bringing in that cultural music with them on horseback or whatnot. But it's a lot easier to move a guitar around than a marimba.
Most definitely.
Dr. Miguel Carranza.
I was just going to reinforce the fact that when we talk about music, we also talk about dance. And
folklore
dance groups have risen dramatically, Latino folklore groups. And it's very interesting because they'll have different types of dress depending on the state they're from. If they're from Jalisco or Oaxaca or Chiapas, they have different kinds of music and style. And then you put in Central America and the Caribbean, and you have just a wide array of styles and the use of marimbas and guitarrones and all sorts of different things.
Well,
it's pretty fascinating.
So many different styles, and what this exhibit, it just encompasses so many different things. So let's talk about the name of the exhibit, Sabor. Mm-hmm. What does it mean, and what is the significance of it that they're trying to portray to people who are coming in and have an experience of what is this exhibit about?
Right, what's it about? Well, American Sabor means flavor. And so when you take, in Espanol, sabor means flavor, and my Espanol is muy malo, so I apologize for my bad Spanish.
That's a great Chicano band.
I can tell you that the exhibit is all about the representation of sort of looking at five geographic areas in the country, looking at San Antonio, looking at Los Angeles, looking at Miami, looking at New York, and looking at, what's the other one?
San Francisco,
and looking at kind of the unique contributions that came out of Latinos in those areas on popular music. So you see in the exhibit, you see large-scale image kiosk with educational texts that accentuate iconic people like Carlos Santana's, like Selena, mm-hmm. like Celia Cruz, like Tito Puente,
Gloria Estefan.
Gloria Estefan, Miami Sound Machine. Yeah. Gosh, I used to have a crush on her
well,
my first
tons,
couple years of
tons
teaching.
There's tons of artists, and I just kept thinking as I was going through it, what was going on in Kansas City while all this was happening? Dr. Seale?
What was going on in Kansas City while all this was happening? What was happening is you had all of these laborers, middle-class workers, just continuing the flavor of music that influenced their childhood. I mean, we've had generations. My own family's been here since 1900. You know, so we brought all of those corridos and all that music that was cultural to us and just included it in our lives. People wanted to dance. Right. And so you had to have these musicians, these local musicians, to provide the instrumentation, the groups. And those groups just grew from, you know, the 40s, 50s, 60s. Mm. My own great uncle and my wife's grandfather played in one of the, I believe, some of the first orchestras, Mexican orchestras, in the 1920s here on the West Side. Mm. So that music, that Mexican music, that orchestration has been here since the early 1900s.
So the Kansas City scene has been thriving during this whole time as well. So it's appropriate for us to have this exhibit here.
If you didn't hang out with us, you wouldn't know.
Well, and I think one of the appropriate things about having the exhibit is the opportunity to blend communities, to blend audiences, to get folks to venture across sort of cultural lines, if you will, within the city. Because the music's for all of us. I mean, the music doesn't have a boundary or a border. It says you can't come here if you're brown. The music says, welcome, everyone. And so we wanted to see this exhibit as an opportunity to partner and to collaborate with various community members. Hence is why the tribute to festival tributes. Hence is why connecting with our friends across the way at the Nelson.
And has the local Latino population been coming to the exhibit?
Yeah, I think we've had some good turnout. Although, you know, as I mentioned to, I think it was Sydney in the sort of the pre-interview for this discussion. You know, the only way I could really definitively answer that is if I was planted in the exhibit every hour, every day to calculate who's coming in. So, but I suspect through the buzz that I'm hearing through our friends in the leadership of the Latino community that people are getting the word out.
Sure.
And we encourage and this show is another way that we appreciate getting the word out so people will come.
Okay. We're going to take a break. We'll continue our conversation about the influence Latinos have had on popular music. Plus, we'll give a listen to some music from our local Latino music scene. You can tell us about your favorite Latino band or style and the influence it's had on you. Give us a call, 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking about the role of Latinos, Latinas, Chicanos, Chicanas have had on influencing popular culture and music post-World War II, from mambo to salsa, Latin jazz, rock, hip-hop, and beyond. Each genre is utterly unique, yet they all honor a dual heritage. We're exploring this topic in light of the Smithsonian exhibit open to the public at the American Jazz Museum called American Sabor. There's going to be a talk tomorrow night. Admission is free at 6 p.m. More information on our website at kcur.org. That song we just heard was called 96 Tears from the band Question Mark and the Mysterians, a band whose members were the children of migrant farm workers who traveled to Michigan each summer to pick crops and then returned to their home in Texas after the harvest season, which I'm going to use this as an opportunity to go back to the 60s and rock and talking about how Latino music was influential in the Chicano movement. We're talking with Dr. Miguel Carranza, director of UMKC Chicano Latino Studies Program, Greg Carroll, chief executive officer at American Jazz Museum. Let's start with the two of you and talking about the role of music and the Chicano civil rights movement.
Okay. I think one of the things I have to say that it's the Latino Studies Program, but it's misspelled and misnamed by lots of people. We're trying to get a stamp at UMKC.
Okay.
But I think the 60s, it was really important because then you start to have the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. Lots of Latinos were drafted, went to the war. They were mainly in the infantry, came back, and they benefiting from the GI Bill, but they came back pretty disappointed in the reception, just as in World War II, and that came out in the music. And so you have a lot of those in the 50s and going into the 60s who were really trying to talk about their experiences, who are trying to make it big in music. So I, you know, they call it the crossover dream, is to make this crossover music. Selena, other people like that who finally get accepted. And so there was an effort there to develop the kind of music, make it go well. And then you also have them coming back from Vietnam, and you have the Chicano moratorium. So you have the walkouts in schools in L.A., all sorts of social political activity going on, and it comes out in the music. You have the United Farm Workers. You have Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, and the United Farm Workers, and you have a group by the name of El Chicano, who talk about the farm workers, and they actually had plays that they developed with their music and talked about the immigrant experience, the farm worker experience, and how bad it was, and still working today trying to get farm workers' rights. So that was a reflection of the times, pretty tumultuous.
And what was the scene like in San Francisco in particular?
Well, I can't really speak to that. What I can speak to is the sort of the more national scene as it relates to the jazz movement, and how the jazz movement paralleled a lot of this, what Dr. Cardanza was talking about, where there was sort of this opportunity to, again, use the music as a catalyst to bring about social change. Many of the artists, whether they were based in San Francisco, New York, Chicago, often took the opportunity as they toured, particularly in the South, and were subject to extreme Jim Crow laws, that they took that opportunity to leverage their celebrityism, if you will, to try to bring about social change. And you know, a great example of it, although it's a little bit of a digression from this conversation, is the work of Ray Charles, who insisted on not playing in a hall because it was forcefully integrating its audience, and mistreating his musicians. So you have a lot of that occurring in the music. And I think the thing about jazz is that you had so many great artists like Charles Mingus, again, Dizzy Gillespie, who not only integrated their musicians, but they made a concerted effort to integrate messages in their music, and doing it in a way that wasn't so covert. It was pretty out there in trying to bring about some social change.
The reason I brought up San Francisco with the anniversary of the March on Washington, Joan Baez performed, and I That's learned true. That she's of Mexican descent, and that she was part of the peace movement, and that was a big part of her rallying cry, and she brought together a lot of people in the area. Can you speak to that, Dr. Uciel Pisina?
Well, I didn't know Joan Baez was Latina until, you know, just recently myself, you know, maybe about 10-15 years ago. But you know what? She did come from privilege. She did. Her family was well-educated from Mexico. But it was refreshing to see her being a grassroots person, getting involved in the movement. And she didn't necessarily, you know, let people know she was Mexican-American for whatever reason. But, you know, she got involved and has made an impact, you know, obviously in the American roots music and, you know, it continues to be an influence today.
I was just going to say that in San Francisco, it was pretty tumultuous in terms of protests against the war. And there were, you know, Santana, other Latinos who were there in music and who were developing the idea of protest music. So it may not have been – at that time, there was a big distinction in the largeness of the population in San Francisco, Latino, and Los Angeles. It was there were many more in Los Angeles, and it made sense to move, ask them to leave schools and protest. So it was a challenge. And so we think of San Francisco and Los Angeles as being two places that were rocking out, were making noise / music and protest.
You know, I was going to add an interesting thing about protest is that a lot of our jazz artists, and there were Latin artists that were integrated in this program too, that did a program called the Jazz Ambassadors, where they were actually sent overseas to become ambassadors. That was a precursor for the USO program. And that ambassador program was interesting, and it sort of put a lot of our jazz artists in a very dilemmatic position, because here they were going overseas to be ambassadors for the United States, but back home they had all this oppression occurring on their people. And so you had people even like Louis Armstrong who refused to go on a couple of trips until there was some social change. But so you see all of this happening, not just in Latin music, but in jazz and other layers of music around the time.
John Curry, director of Marimba Sol de Chiapas?
It's a mouthful. No, just Santana was brought up, and actually that brings up a great point that the bands were actually the model for what everyone was fighting for. They were the melting pot of musicians and from all backgrounds and cultures and socioeconomical positions, whether it was at the Palladium in New York or in Woodstock when Santana stepped on stage. I mean, it's just look to the music you were listening to at the time and enjoying and realize that there's your model for where we need to head still. So,
this is Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're discussing the Latino influences on popular music and culture in the United States. We're going to take a call from Jake in South Kansas City, who called 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. Jake, welcome to Central Standard.
Buenos dias, amigos, amiga.
Buenos dias. Buenos dias.
Three quick things. The difference between Chicano and Latino, and then when did the guitar on the giant guitar, how did that come about? And I can't recall the third. I'm a man of a certain age, and it's escaped.
Well, Jake, let's start with your first two. Dr. Carranza?
Chicano and Latino, I mean, are labels. And Chicano became a real popular term in the 1960s. My father would have never called himself a Chicano, but I did. And it was seen as being political, as protesting. And I was still young, so I wasn't out picketing or anything, but I did when I went to graduate school. But my father was a Mexican-American, so it's generational. And there are still those...
Is it second generation?
I think it's more time connected to the 60s. Okay. And so you call yourself Chicano, we boycotted lettuce, grapes, different things like that. And it was really a reflection of the power of the agricultural industry and how they were really abusing
the etymology of the term Chicano. Latino is obvious to us gringos, but Chicano, what's the etymology? How did it come about, and what's the literal translation?
Well, there are ideas that Chicano came from the Nahuatl called Mexicano. And Mexicano in Nahuatl would be Mexicano. And so that they just cut off the M-E, and it became, instead of Mexicano, it became Chicano. There are also ideas that it came from people from Chihuahua, who came from the state of Chihuahua. There's also ideas that it developed as a term so people from Mexican-Americans in Texas who call themselves Tejanos could distinguish themselves from Chicanos. Mm. So there's a number of different ideas on how the term developed.
It was a social-political term, you know, one that the Mexican-Americans of the time wanting to honor their heritage, their indigenous heritage. And so they took that, you know, from the indigenous word, Nahuatl word of Mexico, Mexica. And so it was something that they took upon themselves, because as Mexican Americans were growing up here in the United States, you know, when we would visit our ancestors in Mexico, we weren't Mexican enough to be Mexicanos, always being criticized for our Spanish, our broken Spanish, or very little of what we knew. And then, of course, we went through the problems here in the United States, so we were like in that no man's land. And so it's a self-imposed term, and same thing Latino, same thing with Latino.
So, Dr. Uciel Pesina, this is kind of brings me to your group, Trio Atzlan. What is the significance of that name of your group?
Well, it's very interesting. Atzlan is the Nahuatl term of the literal term is the Lake of the Reeds, which is the indigenous or the ancestral home of the Aztec people, and we were a bit, you know, young militant college graduates in the 1990s, 91, 92. And so I wasn't good enough to be in my wife's uncle's mariachi, so I thought. And I didn't want to, you know, be disrespectful and start my own young mariachi. So there was no trio music at the time. Mm. And we loved the boleros, the romantic music that I would often hear in my household. And so we thought, hey, there's no trio. Let's start a trio, which meant three guitars, three harmonies, and following that tradition of the bolero.
And describe to us what type of music you play then.
Well, it's it would be music. If you were wanting to romance someone, you would hire a trio. We'd go to the young lady's house, hope that you wouldn't be in trouble. But it's generally accepted.
Would Cumbia Dulce be an appropriate track to play to give dulce, people a sense of what we?
No, but that you know, to talk about the Cumbia Dulce that we wrote, when we started playing, people really enjoyed our thrill music. But the thing is that you can't play 2 hours of romantic music.
Right.
And so what happened was that we had to, you know, as many groups spread out and learn different genres of Latin music. So
right.
We play, rumba, we play boleros and cumbia, and a little bit of Latin rock.
So it's once the romance begins, then you get them dancing.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, we're going to hear Cumbia Dulce right now. That's Cumbia Dulce from Trio Atlan, Dr. Uciel Pesina's group, who performs here locally. He's assistant professor of education administration at UMKC. We brought this up earlier, singing in Spanish. Some people, Chicanos, sometimes don't feel confident to sing in Spanish. There's a lot of controversy over Latino or Latina artists who switch over and have an English album and a Spanish album. We think of Richie Valdez, who didn't know how to sing La Bamba and had to learn it phonetically. How much is the Spanish language, you know, so important to this, or is it growing beyond that?
Well, I think that it's important. There are lots of artists who will sing, both in English and in Spanish. And there are some things you can say in one language that you can't say in another. So if you say amor, you know, that has a real ring to it in Spanish. And you can say love, and that sounds okay, too. And women appreciate it, and men appreciate it if you love them. But there are some phrases that you say in one language or another. And I think that there have always been artists, Latino, Latina artists, who've made a real concerted effort to sing in both languages and have been successful. Others have been less successful, but in terms of people buying their music. But I don't think it's necessarily reflective of their talent. So I think that singing in any music is, and in terms of this exhibit called American Sabor, it's a flavor. I would hope that people would come and to the American Jazz Museum and not see it just as jazz music, but much
right.
more diverse,
right.
and would taste, you know, not just for Latinos, but everybody to really get a taste of the variety of music and what it means to a culture, but also what it means to other cultures who are influenced by it. Because
right.
one of the things we often overlook is the influence of Latino music on other musicians. So you have Ry Cooder and others who've taken the Buena Vista Social Club and,
yeah.
and moved it as well.
Right.
Dr. Uciel Pesina,
you had Nat King Cole singing
right.
in Espanol, you know?
That's right.
I mean, it
right.
just opens up the world, you know, different world to you, another world to you. I mean, I just, you know, God rest her soul, Edie Gourmet just passed away, and we were talking about that. I didn't know she was a Sephardic Jew, and so she also had Spanish heritage in her, and she was a translator. I didn't know all that. And when she came to the scene with the trio Los Panchos, man, it just blew away all types of record sales, and she became even more popular in Latin America than here in the United States.
And the exhibit is bilingual.
As we're
about to wrap out of time, I want to get to dance, which we didn't talk a whole lot about, but it's a big part of the exhibit and a big part of some of the events that are coming up at the American Jazz Museum. Greg Carroll, can you talk to us about some of those?
Yeah. So dance in the exhibit, there's actually a dance floor and a jukebox where you can test out your salsa moves. And in the educational packet that's available, you have a lesson on how to do basic salsa. The museum is also scheduling, along with the exhibit, and this is through the generous support of the Ford Motor Company Fund, we've been able to fashion 15 different public programs that will run sort of in concurrence with the exhibit at the museum. And one of them includes a competition, and we're calling it El Ritmo. And El Ritmo, there's three forms of competition. There's already been the band competition, which was done at our Festival of Tributes. People go on social media and they vote for their favorite band. Coming up is an opportunity for spoken word artists through jazz to have a El Ritmo spoken word competition. And then we're going to close out the series with El Ritmo Dance Off, where we're partnering with different dance entities in town and asking them to send us their winning dance couple.
Nice.
And we'll select the winning dancers, and they each win $1,000.
And you can find out all that information on our website.
That's
at KCUR.org. Before we go, Dr. Lucille Pessina and John Curry, how can Kansas Cityans get involved in their local Latino music scene? Where can you find information about shows and what's going on?
Well, we keep our shows listed at MexicanMarimba.com, but much following the San Francisco Park tradition of drumming, there's actually drumming that goes on Sunday nights that's rumba-based. The Cuban tradition, and then Monday night is more of a general open circle. And then some of the usual, anything from plastic sax to the pitch, those sort of calendars.
And with us, it's triwaslan.com at Facebook. We just list all of our performances. And, to plug a local restaurant, we're the house band down at on the Boulevard at Manny's. And they also provide information when we play down there. So we've been there for over 20 years.
So the Latin music scene in Kansas City is alive and well.
In the Blue Room.
Yeah.
We're out of time. I want to thank Dr. Miguel Carranza, director of the UMKC Latino Studies Program, Greg Carroll, the American Jazz Museum, John Curry, director of Marimba Sol de Chiapas.
Thanks, Suzanne.
And Dr. Lucille Pessina, member of Trio Aztlan. Tune in tomorrow for Central Standard as we look at horse populations in a new exhibit at the Nelson Atkins Museum. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and myself, with help from Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. Up to Date is next with a look at the first woman to hold a cabinet position. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and this is Central Standard on KCUR. Enjoy the day.